You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. I'm your co-host, Mark Newbold, and joining me today is a man who is such a luminous being, he makes all the matte lines disappear. It's Mark Mulcaster. Mark, how are you doing?
I am simply glowing with confidence for this week's episode.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah, how are you doing, dude?
Oh, very well, thank you, very well. Yeah, all good. Life is busy in the Star Wars world. We've got loads and loads and loads to talk about on the show today. How are you?
Yeah, very well. It has been a very busy week for Star Wars and a nice quiet afternoon, which means that we can talk Star Wars and just have a lot of fun doing it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, we've had plenty of news land today, but before we get to our news, we'll do our regular thing of asking each other, what random crap has turned up to your house this week, Mark?
Well, one random piece of crap that is being sent back because it was sent from Hasbro Pulse and it's f***ing bent and stuff. It's the Obi-Wan Kenobi Darth Vader Dark Times figure, which has got a whacking great big crease across the top, which is unacceptable in my standards, so I'm sending it back.
I've not had a huge amount turn up this week. Sort of a few patches turned up and a few sort of little pins and bits, different places in the States have come across, but nothing much to speak of. I've got my copy of The Princess and the Scoundrel, which I've started, which so far is very, very good. And I'm ploughing through my comics and really enjoyed that. And I'm now feeling foolish for not staying on top of it much more. It's all good. This week's episode, we are going to have a look at what's going on in the galaxy right now. And as we speak today, Andor has dropped a new trailer and some pictures and a poster and the news that the show will not debut now on the 31st of August with two episodes, but on the 21st of September with three episodes. So before I ramble on forever, what do you make of that?
The date change, a little disappointing, but it's not like it's been moved back 6 months. It's only really been moved back a month, if not even that, really, like 3 weeks. Having three episodes in one night, I tell you what, I'm going to have to make sure that I get home early, because normally by about 9 o'clock, I watch an episode and that's it. I'm in bed and asleep. So I'm going to have to make sure I get up, get a nice clear morning at least, so I can sit down and watch all three episodes, and then probably we'll end up having to watch them all over again when Karen comes in. I suppose the good thing is that actually with Andor, we've got 12 episodes. And obviously when we had three episodes basically in a week for Kenobi, that was pretty much half a series. And so it seemed like a bit of a wasted opportunity. But with this, barring the actual amount of content I'm going to have to, you know, churn through in a day to avoid spoilers, I'm not really too fussed about it, because I think, you know, we're still going to have like another nine episodes that we can watch, and maybe they could do another double episode at the end, or, you know, just to wrap up the last couple episodes and the finale. But is three episodes one too many? Could they maybe have done 2 weeks or two double episodes perhaps?
Yeah, I like that idea far more. I think you're probably right. I think two, well, like you say, with Kenobi, you know, you have the two episodes on the Friday and then you had another episode on the Wednesday. So by the time we were, or well, some of us who were at Celebration got home from Celebration, you know, the show was half done, because by the following Wednesday, you're on episode four and then two episodes to go when you were out. So Kenobi really felt like it was in and out way too quickly, when it really was getting people talking, and it was definitely one of those little mini zeitgeist moments where everyone was talking about Kenobi and Darth Vader and all the stuff that we saw. With this, like you say, you know, this is 12 episodes. They're all, you know, if they were network TV show programs with adverts in, they'd be an hour-long show, pretty much, give or take. So they're pretty regular length episodes. Having three on the opening day, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, obviously it's a longer story. You know, Tony Gilroy spoke about this, and he's already sort of told us the framework for season two, in that, you know, you get chunks of three stories set within a year,
blocks of three.
And the next three stories are a year later, and the next three stories, and this one's about 5 years out. So we're a fair way before Rogue One and A New Hope at this point. But still, it's going to be weird to have three episodes on that one day, because folks like us are going to want to do our reaction chats. So we'll end up doing like we did with Kenobi, where we'll do the first three episodes in one episode and we'll blast through that. And all the other stuff that we do and all of the sites and pods and social media feeds will do is we'll all try and plough through it and watch it as quick as we can. The problem I personally have with that I don't want to have to plow through Star Wars at speed.
No.
I want to enjoy it. I want to savour it. Yeah. I want this to be on for 12 weeks. I don't want it to be on for 9 weeks. I want it to be a 12-week thing. I want to wake up on a Wednesday at 8 o'clock or whatever. I want this to be on as long as it can be on for. Because we're only getting 24 episodes in total. If they do a season two, they'll do a 12-episode season two. And it,
exactly.
By the sounds of it, it'll take us bumper to bumper with Rogue One, which is where we want to be. And that's it. So why rush it? I don't get why we're rushing it.
I've got three thoughts. I mean, obviously the date push could just simply be because maybe some of our later episodes have still got a little bit of work to be done in post-production, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, isn't a big stretch because I know I work on shows all the time, but the first two or three episodes go out and then you're working on maybe the fourth or fifth. Either because obviously the schedule's pushed and they're going to potentially run into the back of something else that they don't necessarily want to then shunt that schedule down. So it could be something to do with that. Or I wonder if maybe this is Disney just maybe experimenting with the idea of the binge-watching culture, i.e. we give you 3 episodes and see how that plays with the fan base. And that, you know, you think about Stranger Things and how people watch the whole season in a day. But I wonder if it's something like that, or if it is literally just, yeah, it's just a schedule thing. They need it finished at a certain point for whatever reason, because of the next show or something like that. And maybe it does tie into Bad Batch. That'd be pretty cool if we finish Andor season one and then the events kind of get reflected in the Bad Batch. That would be quite an interesting kind of take.
It would be. If we're only worrying about scheduling for Star Wars, and it's a case of Star Wars not overlapping with other Star Wars, that's fine, because over in the Star Trek universe, they've just had, I think they've had something insane, like you've had 52 weeks consecutive with an episode of Star Trek, be it Lower Decks, Prodigy, Picard, Discovery, and Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
And now Strange New Worlds has finished its first season. There's nothing on at the moment until Lower Decks starts up again later this month. That's fantastic scheduling. That's great. Star Trek fans are in a really good place right now because they've got multiple shows. They're just running, one finishes and the next one's ready to go. And Marvel, you'd like to think, would want to be in a similar situation. Maybe not quite so bumper to bumper because they want to drop films in as well. Disney Plus are looking and going, well, we don't want that Star Wars show overlapping with that Marvel show or Pixar car show that's coming next month or whatever it might be. Then I think there's grounds for frustration in that me, as a Star Wars fan, I'm like, if I watch Cars, which I will because I like Cars, or if I watch anything else that's on Disney Plus, Marvel or whatever, that's for me to schedule. But as a Star Wars fan, I'd like a nice steady stream of Star Wars content. Like, for example, and we're going to talk about it in a minute, Light and Magic. If they'd put out an episode of Light and Magic, either one a week for 6 weeks, or even episode one on Monday, episode two on Tuesday, episode three on Wednesday, and done it that way, that yeah. makes me want to come back to Disney Plus, because everything's so much more immediate now. We're not going to ever wait 3. Well, we are waiting 3 years for the next film, but you know what I'm saying? We're never going to go for that amount of time with nothing else in between, and you're relying on your books and your comics to keep your fandom up and busy. We've got loads to keep us up and busy.
So what do you make of the trailer then? 2 minutes, just 2.5 minutes. And it seems to, at least from my eyes, kind of focus not so much on Andor as the main protagonist, but it seems to focus a lot on this Luthen, is it?
Luthen.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, Luthen. So what did you make of that trailer?
I like the trailer a lot. We saw some clips before. We've got a vibe for it. It's definitely got that Rogue One feel. You know, it's got that early dawn, late dusk, slightly damp and raining feel, which I love in Star Wars. That's something we used to throw into our role play a lot. So I love that feel of, you know, just a real place, you get dirt under your fingernails kind of place. So I love the aesthetic of that. You know, in Mando, when you saw like the chop fields when they were chopping up the starfighters when they found Migs Mayfeld, and this is like that, but on a Star Cruiser scale. So you're getting the feel of industrial feel. We saw some photographs as well. There's some images. There was a sort of 10 images as well. So we know that we get to go to Coruscant because you see the Senate looking lovely and pristine, like you imagine it wouldn't have done after Palpatine and Yoda smashed the crap out of it in Revenge of the Sith. We see Saw Gerrera, you know, there's, I mean, clearly it's a completely stamps down on the point that it's a Rogue One prequel, which is great because, you know, you've got the Partisan element coming in. You saw Partisan Rebels from Rogue One and just different little elements that really give you that feel that the net's closing in on this sort of early rebellion, because we're still 5 years before Star Wars. So, you know, you're seeing an ISB agent in the white coat and stuff like that. So you're seeing all these different little elements that all merge together. Even see Cassian looking like he's in Imperial uniform at one point, which we saw him do in Rogue One. So there's a kind of a backwards precedent for that. I really liked it, and I liked the music as well.
Yeah, me too. I thought the music was quite interesting. Different vibe to what we've had before, which I hope they follow that through actually into the series and it's not just trailer music.
Mm.
But yeah, I do like this. I like this dude going around the galaxy, so it seems, and you know, seemingly trying to reactivate or focus Saw Gerrera. Because as we know, even from what we kind of saw in like Star Wars Rebels, and that he's a bit of a loose cannon, Matt. So it'd be interesting to see actually what he's doing at this point in time before he kind of really gets wrapped up in any form of alliance or proto-alliance. They talked about, or there's clearly a desire with this film, because it's got to match the aesthetic of not only Rogue One, but really A New Hope. There seems to be a lot less reliance on the stagecraft tech, so using the volume, which I'm sure they probably will do for some bits, but it seems like obviously it's quite nice to go to that village, which kind of looks a bit deserty, which they had out in like Little Marlow, which we spoke about a lot, I think, last year or the year before, the kind of a hilly kind of like mountain area from Scotland that we saw photos of again
from
production and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It gives it a lot grander scale, even if the stories are going to be kind of smaller potentially. You know, because we're not talking about Darth Vader, we're not talking about Obi-Wan Kenobi, but it feels like already this is a lot more of a big cinematic event, even though it's happening on the smaller screen, which is fantastic.
That's a really good observation, actually, that you take two pillars of Star Wars in terms of characters and tell actually what was quite a personal, fairly small story, even though visually there was plenty of scope and the action was there and all the import was there and the Emperor's in it and all that stuff. But this one, like you say, because it feels more boots on the ground and inverted commas smaller, you get the scope. You're clearly on a couple of three planets in this trailer alone, you know, and you see Coruscant, so you know we're going to Coruscant. Mm-hmm. That's right there. We've seen Saw Gerrera, so maybe we're going to Jeddah. If that's where Saw was holed up with the Partisan Rebels at that point of time, then we're going to Jeddah. So there's an exciting thought that we could see that as well. I think this is actually going to be a much bigger story in terms of scope and scale than you might imagine when people, even just a few months ago, were online going, whoever asked for a story about Cassian Andor?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And now I think you might be just a few weeks away from the answer.
This is Adam Christopher, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So as an early Christmas present, Lucasfilm and Disney Plus have given us the six-part documentary series Light and Magic, directed by Lawrence Kasdan, starring primarily George Lucas, who sits down and speaks directly to camera throughout the series. It gives you a real, genuine feel of what it was like to be one of those crazy kids sliding around on slip and slides, getting two visual effects done by the time Lucas rocks up back from filming in the UK and John Dykstra is trying to hold it all together, failing in places but completely massively succeeding in others. What have you made of it so far, Mark? It's been a joy and I want to watch it again.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, absolutely. This has been probably one of the highlight series I've actually watched on Disney Plus. Mm. You know, this will be one of those things that I will probably watch again because I think it's just so interesting. I mean, obviously, it's adjacent to the kind of field that I now work in. And yeah, I mean, what I've really liked is how the personalities of these guys have come out. Because to be fair, if you go back and you watch stuff like Empire of Dreams and stuff like that, it's a little bit stuffy. It's told in such a way whereby in the past it's always been, you know, felt like John Dykstra was a negative influence as much as he was a positive, you know, and that the parting seemed to be quite acrimonious and stuff. And maybe it kind of was, but at least he seems a bit bitter. It's going to be down to how it's edited. And let's forget that, you know, these are all interviews which should probably last several hours, maybe over across a couple of days in some instances, like, you know, Dennis Mirren and people like that have been around for absolutely freaking ages.
Yeah.
So there is obviously context and there's also editorialized positions and stuff like that you've got to take into account. However, it's just nice to see ILM getting the focus because that's always a thing, isn't it? You know, you watch any making of Star Wars and you read any making of Star Wars book, they always talk about, you know, how ILM was kind of created and, you know, they were just in this Van Nuys like industrial space and they didn't do anything for 6 months and they spent $1 million on, you know, nothing really but developing the tech. And it's always come across as being a little bit like these were the guys who were basically just sat around getting smashed and eating pizza and stuff like that and really wasting George's money and time. But actually, this story has kind of given you the kind of perspective of actually, well, actually, no, of course, they've had to basically reinvent the wheel from scratch and reinvent technology that kind of existed, but twisting it to what they actually needed to do. So I found this absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I put a thing on social media earlier in response to something that somebody said praising Light and Magic. And I said, that I think those guys were so ingenious and so clever that if they'd have been given the problem of getting Apollo 13 home, they would have not only figured it out, but they'd have probably done a flyby over the White House just because they could. You know, they just seem to be able to figure things out, literally pull things out of thin air. And you see a number of examples. You know, we've spoke to Lorne Peterson before, and he's a problem solver. And we spoke to Nelson Hall at London Film and Comic Con a few years ago, and he was another. You know, these guys are coming up with these ingenious ways of figuring out obstacles that in the moment, George is just sort of smiling and saying, "You'll figure it out. We don't know how to do that, George. There's no process for doing this. We can't. You'll figure it out."
I love it.
And he's saying it now, looking back with a real sort of, you can see where Yoda gets his mischievousness from. It's from George. "Oh, I knew they'd figure it out. I knew they'd do it." And of course they do. You make a great point though about, for example, Dykstra, that he was the right guy to build those rigs. They weren't just dicking about for 12 months doing nothing. They were building these things. Obviously, the Dykstra Flex we know all about that are just amazing. But one thing that really stood out to me, and it also comes across in the Icons Unearthed documentary as well, what we've seen of that so far. Interview with Brian Volkweis, by the way, on Fanthatrax Radio, if you get a chance to listen. The attitude towards Gary Kurtz, he's generally not being praised, credited much. If anyone's a scapegoat, he's become the scapegoat. And it strikes me that he's the one big name in the process of all of this, especially Star Wars and Empire, that's just not around to defend himself. I don't know whether you picked up on that.
Between those two things, I think the one thing that, and I could be misremembering from the Icons Unleashed documentary, but I'm pretty sure in that, John Dykstra lays claim to him coming up with the
ILM name.
And then you've got George kind of saying it, and it's exactly the same kind of explanation, but actually George's is a little bit more vague. And it was just one of those kind of things I went, it could be that it was John and George in the same conversation and they came up with it together. Who knows? I mean, it's one of those minor things, not even like a big deal, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, and unless you were there, you're never probably going to really know the truth, no. I don't think.
It's such a melting pot of geniuses, and I think that's the big takeaway, especially from Light and Magic. You know, Icons on Earth is still ongoing, but Light and Magic's all out there now.
I think, actually, the most poignant thing, and I don't think I've ever seen this on camera at all ever, George getting emotional about that car accident he had.
Yeah.
Wow. You could see it in his eyes. Yeah. This was clearly not just a juvenile, I wrap my car around the tree kind of thing, but I did when I was like 18, 19, and ended it up in a concrete kind of slab and stuff like that. Got out and walked away, and then just had to be chastised by my dad. Obviously, George ended up in hospital, and that is clearly a life-defining moment. And so just actually having that by his own words as well, it's priceless because we're very much aware actors of a certain age and just how vital they are to the history of these franchises, but also just how little time they all have left. Just seeing that kind of moment, I think, is fantastic. That's partly the brilliance of actually having Lawrence Kasdan do the actual interviews, because he knows all these characters really well from that era. And so I think that in itself is helpful. It's like, if you were to interview me, it's like, we're friends already. So you've already broken down that barrier. Mm. You've made me kind of relaxed. And that's how you get the best out of people.
Yeah, it does come across. And there are, like you say, some surprisingly candid moments in there. For all the people that say Lucasfilm back in the day were quite open, you'd have rings that would have great access. You got all the behind the scenes stuff that we used to get. We don't seem to get that so much now from Disney. I think now with a documentary like this has suddenly made you go, wow, well, actually, they're not sugarcoating a lot of this stuff. Dennis Muren, I didn't realise the close connection between Muren and Tippett, their partners and the whole how close they are. So I didn't know any of that. And then it all came good anyway, and everybody's happy and moves on. But just these bitter moments, they left it in there. I love that they left it in there, that it's not all roses and happiness and light, that it was a journey that they had to get through.
I think part of that is because obviously a lot of these guys are now looking back 40 years removed from these events at the, if they're not at the end of their career, they're in the twilight years at least. And like you said, like Phil Tippett, just opens up about, "I'm bipolar.
Yeah.
I had good days and bad days." To be fair, I've seen interviews with Phil Tippett and I thought, "You're an absolute dick." And now you kind of go, put that all into perspective and you just kind of go, well, let's take a step back here, Mark. These guys, all of them, and women, because actually that was one thing that I seemed to notice more just in the photos of that. There was a lot more women in ILM than I think you kind of realise, because it's always, the same characters who are kind of wheeled out for all the documentaries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But actually there was a lot of women who were very clever and helped to keep everything running and keep it ticking over, and, you know, possibly without them as well, we wouldn't have had Star Wars on the 25th of May.
Totally.
If at all.
Totally, totally, totally. Yeah, Chrissy England and Rose Duggan and people like that. When they get to the E.T. stuff, how involved Kathleen Kennedy was and how they would all decamp up to Kerner for weeks and weeks and weeks, and how Spielberg knew these guys and loved hanging out with them and enjoyed the atmosphere and just that whole teamster feel of not just Lucasfilm, because George said, well, if Stephen wants it, Hitch Stephen has it. And then they open it up to Rotha Khan and Star Trek suddenly got it. And then Star Wars is finishing and all of a sudden ILM, obviously, are the effects house. Tobe Hooper's doing stuff. Robert Zemeckis is doing stuff. And everybody in the mid-80s is going to ILM for the big effects stuff. Just fascinating. If we've not said it clearly enough, if you haven't watched Light and Magic, go and watch Light and Magic. It's an absolute joy. And I hope that at some juncture, we get to sit down with people like Ben Burtt and David Accord and Matt Wood and get a little bit of history on Skywalker Sound as well, because there's definitely a story to tell there. But for what it is, Light and Magic, absolutely brilliant. Hats off to Lucasfilm and to Disney+.
Hi, this is Guy Henry, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks. Enjoy.
So we're going back to Blackburn, back to May 2022, for the last one of our Star Wars Fan Fun Day interviews. This is with Joe Gibson. He played a snowtrooper and a stormtrooper in The Empire Strikes Back. He was a Gamorrean guard and a stormtrooper in Return of the Jedi. He's done loads of stuff. We had the chance to sit down with him and have a chat. So this is Joe Gibson. So here at Star Wars Fan Fun Day, I'm sat next to Joe Gibson. How's it going, Joe?
We're good, good. Had a lovely day, and they really looked after us. Very nice. I'm so glad I came.
You enjoy meeting folks and chatting about your experiences?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it was my life for a, and it still is, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I've loved all the movies I've done. I couldn't get enough of it, you know?
Where did your journey in film begin?
My journey in film began with a guy named David Tomlin, who was a top first assistant director and a very good director in his own right. He'd done Danger Man and The Prisoner, wrote and directed some of the, I think the first four episodes. A good friend of Patrick McGoohan, who I knew very well. David was also my mentor and my snooker partner in a club in Northwest London, you know. He looked after me, you know.
And was it your relationship with David that brought you into Star Wars?
Well, it was, because he'd done Bridge Too Far, and he took me with him to Holland. I was there for 6 months working with Dickie as location coordinator, parking all the trucks and buses and armoured vehicles and God knows what else that came down the road. You know? And I'd done the full 6 months and I loved every minute of it. You know, my wife came out and stayed with me. She ended up working on the casting with all the Dutch guys that were playing extras and everything. And we had a brilliant time. You know. And then when we came back, he was doing Empire. And he asked me if I wanted to stand in for, you know, one of the artists. And I said, who? And he said, well, Luke Skywalker. And I said, yeah. I said, yeah, that'll do me. Thank you very much. So I'd done Luke right through the movie.
Yeah.
And then when that ended, I'd done Raiders of the Lost Ark for him, where I stood into up at EMI. I stood in for Ronnie Lacey.
Yeah.
All the stuff that went on in EMI. And then when they went to Tunisia, they got me out to Tunisia to do location coordination for the for about 5 weeks we were out there.
Yeah.
And another time, loved it.
You know? What did that entail, that job?
They were the same thing. Anything that come down the road, you and me, because not just film unit people, unfortunately, they want to park where they like, you know, and you can't do that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of the Tunisians were au fait with film, so they would block the dirt tracks of the roads, you know. So I had to literally design a one-way system in and out and stop them parking their trucks in the middle of the road and blocking everything. And I was out there for the full term and came back and then went on for other movies, you know, and I ended up forming my own company.
Yeah.
I used to work with Quinton Pier, was in Raiders and was in Star Wars, you know, and we got to be good friends. And we come around the corner and they say, oh, Christ, here comes the A-team. Quinton and myself, you and me. Yeah. So I took it and formed a company called the A-team Agency.
Nice.
The A-team Film and TV Agency, just doing location, security and coordination, you and me. And it worked. And I've been doing it ever since.
It's interesting you say about the logistics. Something like as simple as a roadway in for people. It's not something somebody like me, who's just a film fan, would even think of.
No, well, that was the problem. David, that's why he employed me. David knew when you were on location, You lost a lot of time by stupid things like that, you know. Sadly, you'd get, you know, somebody turn up and they say, but I need all my gear. And you say, what's your gear? And you'd open the boot, you know, and they've got a bag, a handbag.
Yeah.
You know, say, well, park your car down, carry your gear with you, you know. And also, you'd find things like the Sparks, you'd get their trucks as near as possible because they're carrying big lamps and cable and all that. So you'd get them as near as possible because David had designed the locate, you know, the where they were going to shoot this and where they were going to shoot that.
Yeah.
And he'd say, right, I want this there, this, that there, that, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And you, in the end, you could look at a field and you could literally see how many vehicles you could get in that field. And the same on Gandhi. I mean, Gandhi was horrendous. Gandhi was horrendous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The crowds that turned up just trying to get the vehicles up and down the road.
Yeah.
And none of them knew how to park. You know, they just didn't, they never thought of backing into a space and causing and doing lanes of traffic.
Yeah.
They would just dump them anywhere, you know. It was like an abandoned, how can you put it, abandon your vehicle now, you know. So you had to straighten all of that out, and hence that's where I came in.
Wow. You know? That's fascinating, that's absolutely fascinating. Now, we did have a question that I've been asked to ask you. So the question was, if he gets to chat with Joe at the show, the main question is, did he get photographed as Boba Fett in 1983 on a green screen set?
I can't say for definite. I know I was in the thing with Gino Marotta, you know, doing green screen, you know, and we've done a lot of green screen. But, you know, so long ago and my age now, the memory isn't good. I can't remember if I did, you know. I do remember, and I mean, I just told a lad the story there, that we were doing a set with Gino just before dinner, and it was on the green screen, and a young actor, he was supposed to be like the commander of the battle cruiser, and his sidekick was supposed to say to him, enemy fleet attacking, sir. He's supposed to be looking at the green screen, you know?
Yeah.
And he's supposed to say, well, double the power on all the forward defence shields, you know?
Yeah.
What? Double the power on all the forward defence shields. Okay, I said, Gino, right, stand by, right. So, turn over, action. Enemy fleet attacking, sir. The kid says, well, double the power on all the forward, cut, do it again. Kid lad, I did feel sorry. He must have done it about four times and he screwed the line up each time.
Yeah.
Now, everybody on the set could say the line, you know. Even one of the painters is sweeping the floor, you know. He's saying, double the power on all the forward defence shield. Double the power on all the forward. So while they're doing it, the phone went, you know, and he was nearest to the organ where the phone was, and he said, no, don't cut the power. We're shooting, don't cut the power. Gina Morrell said, what's that? He said, it's the powerhouse. He said, what do they want? He said, they want to know if you want to double the power on all the forward defensive. Well, I did feel sorry for this young lad. We were absolutely wet. Gina went, cut, all right. He said, call a quarter, we're going to dinner, you know. He said, you better learn the line when we come back. Priceless story. One of the, you know, the perks of the game, you know, you get some fabulous stories.
Yeah. Well, we ain't going to top that. That was a brilliant story. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
All the best.
The best to you.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
So, man of the moment, Lawrence Kasdan has just directed and overseen the six-part documentary Light and Magic, showing now on Disney+. Absolute joy to watch. Also, of course, he was involved with Solo, A Star Wars Story. And whilst talking about Light and Magic, Solo came up in conversation and he gives a great quote. This is Kasdan in relation to a sequel to Solo. No, there's not any talk of that. I've never been particularly drawn to expanding it into a show, but I do talk to John, that's John Kasdan, his son, and Ron Howard, a lot about what went right and what went wrong with the Solo experience. This is the key line. I would be more interested in doing another movie, not a TV series. What do you make of that? A lot of people, we're looking forward to Lando. We're thinking that, you know, the stars align, we'd get a Solo TV series, or maybe Han could be used in other things. Kasdan would be more interested in a film than a TV show. Do you think that's viable, given that the previous film just did not do very well at the box office?
No, if I'm honest. sorry, I just don't think it is. And I hope to God, as with most of the conversation and speculation we have on this podcast, I'm completely wrong about it. And actually, we do end up with one. But yeah, I just don't see it. I think even though it was a misstep at the highest levels of Disney to put that film out when they did, I just think that they feel like it was also the subject matter a little bit. The business has changed, the focus has changed. I would be so up for Solo 2 in the cinema, and I can understand it. I mean, you know, maybe there is still that kind of stigma, isn't there, really? But, you know, whilst I think it's becoming less and less and less, and maybe that's just down to people realising and accepting if they want to work beyond a certain age and after they've maybe been around a bit and the limelight has maybe slipped a little bit from them to focus on somebody else, some new talent, streaming is where it's at. I think maybe Lawrence is just like, well, I'm a screenwriter. I write for the cinema, for, you know, the big theatrical screen. So I don't think I want to get involved in the nitty gritty of a streaming series like that. Ironically, bearing in mind that he directed Light and Magic, which is a streaming series, but different altogether. Yeah. Or it could just be down to the fact that maybe, and as I've heard before, I think the residuals for working on a streaming series is nowhere near as lucrative as working on a theatrical release.
It's a tricky one. I think we've dissected Solo since we started this podcast. With Solo, if Disney Plus was where it is now, I don't think Solo would have even been designed as a film. That being said, Kasdan worked on Solo before he was working on Force Awakens. George wanted Solo as a film. So I get that there's an overhang to the past with Solo more than there is to pretty much anything else. With Solo as a character, the sort of character that you can throw into a series of adventures in a way that you probably can't with Luke, because Luke's got a lot of other mythology tied up with him. I think it's no accident that Solo was the character after A New Hope came out that they said, yeah, let him have the first comic arc in the Marvel comic. Let Brian Daley go and write that trilogy of Han Solo books, because if you just give a writer, you've got Solo, Chewie, the Falcon, a couple of loose references to other bits and bobs, but generally we want you to create brand new stuff, but just with those three things, Solo, Falcon, Chewie, that's it. Nothing else. Go and do it. And a writer of Daley's quality, Brian Daley's quality, can do a trilogy of stories that feels as Star Wars as anything else that's ever come out. That tells you what a strong character Solo is. To do these sort of adventurous job-to-job type storylines, he's going to bounce around the galaxy, he's going to meet interesting people. You'll be introduced to people that he's dealing with all the time that you've never seen or heard of before, but instantly they feel like they're part of everything else. That's what that Solo trilogy did. The second trilogy was great, A.C. Crispin's, but we were more into a sort of integrated storyline galaxy by then. So there was more things to fold into that trilogy, but the original one was mega clean. And I think Solo as a character in a Disney Plus series could be just tremendous fun. If you want a touchstone that people are going to get, let's say for the summer of the storyline of the season one of Solo, he just happens to be working for Jabba the Hutt. He doesn't always work for Jabba, but let's say he is. So he goes off and does a job, comes back to the palace. Jabba gives him the next job, off he goes, whatever it might be. You know, so you put in touchstones that people are going to recognise, but for the most part, Han, Chewie and the Falcon going off and doing stuff. I think Kasdan would write the absolute hell out of that. But I get what he's saying about doing it as a film, because like you just said, you probably get better paid. It's probably less of a time constraint on a writer writing 1 2-hour film as opposed to 6 1-hour episodes or whatever it might be, you know.
Exactly.
So there's, you know, there's all of that to fold in. But I think it'd be brilliant.
You do have to be a little bit careful, don't you, with all the legacy characters. How can you keep things being tied into them, but yet not lose that magic of how everybody gets connected and put together in that original trilogy? Like, if Han gets too caught up with doing stuff for a rebellion, he becomes a well-known rebel sympathizer. I suppose in some respects, you could actually double down on the fact that he is for money, and maybe season one or season two of the Solo TV series, okay, yes, you see him dump his spice, but also maybe you see him screw over some of the rebel lines. I would love that, just based on profit, you know, kind of really doubling down on the fact that actually, at, you know, the start of A New Hope, he just wants the 17,000 credits just to take the old man and the boy to Alderaan, and he's done. Doesn't want to get up and end into any of his kind of idealistic, you know, freedom fighter nonsense and stuff. That would be quite fun, but you do run the risk. And I mean, I think even the critics were kind of saying this about Kenobi. It's just like, mining these legacy characters for new stories also feels a little bit safe. It's tried and tested ground, so you know you're probably going to be all right. And whatever you do with any of these characters, as long as you don't screw the pooch too badly, you're not going to go too wrong, really. Mm. But actually, at the same time, it's not really pushing the envelope, is it, at all? And maybe this is just kind of because we're in that no man's land before a new film comes out, and they don't really know what the film is, and we don't really know what the direction is, so therefore they can't actually then start to point the streaming series in those kind of directions. But hell, do it. Make Solo 2 happen, and make Lando happen.
Hi there, this is Mike Quinn. I played Nine-Num in Return of the Jedi and the new trilogy, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So we're heading back to Olympia, London Film and Comic Con, in July of this year, and me and you, Mark, we stood at the desk of Sid Ragg, who was a stormtrooper in A New Hope. We had a little chat whilst he was in between signing autographs. So this is me and you, me and Mark, talking to Sid Ragg at London Film and Comic Con in the Star Wars Zone.
So we're here at London Film and Comic Con. We're in the Star Wars Zone. We're here with Sid Ragg, who is in A New Hope. Sid, how is it going?
Beautiful. It's been a lovely, lovely day. People have been so lovely, actually. It's just nice to meet them, you know, and sign autographs. They're so always so pleasant. I feel quite humble, actually. I feel I should be signing their autographs.
Oh, well, we can do that. We can sort that out.
Later on.
Well, yeah. Do you enjoy telling your story? I mean, it's a long way back now.
Yes. And the big thing on that, on New Hope, the helmet I wore, they found my name and it just Sid. Could hardly see it, but it was Sid. Somebody in California saw it and thought, this has got to be worth something. And yeah, it was. And they had an auction at IMAX on the 19th of September 2019.
Nice. Yeah.
And it went for £130,000.
Wow.
And when we were doing A New Hope, nobody thought it was ever going to do anything. We thought it was just a joke. Everybody did, you know. And the gear we used to chuck away at the end of the film. I wish I'd kept that.
So what were your... I mean, you say everybody thought it was going to be nothing.
No, it was a joke. It was a joke. It really was, you know. But it just took off. I mean, everybody became millionaires apart from the people who worked on it. Apart from us.
So how did they describe the role to you when they talked about it, explained as a stormtrooper?
Yeah. I've always done martial arts all my life, you know, and I was in lots of fighting scenes always, especially as a stormtrooper.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I did lots of time chasing Mark, fighting Mark and the princess. And capturing them.
You know, were you at the scene where they swing across the
I was the second one out. There was Jazza, the stuntman. He fell, and I was on the second one on the right-hand side.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wicked.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And Mark was lovely. He was lovely. Yeah. The space buggy that I used to drive, the wagon, it was a bit devious to drive. You sit there or stand there, you guide that way, but it would go that way.
So it took some time
to get used to it. You know, Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, was dying to have a go at this. And George, the producer, Lucas, he said, Sid, don't let him have a go, because it only mess it up. And he, one day, pushed me off, he took it away, and he whirled about like a big dervisher, and he hit the wing of a plane, and he came off. And George didn't see it. I mean, George Lucas. He didn't see it. He was in another shot. So the guys came along and mended it before, you know, they knew about it. I actually wrote about it in a poem once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did that, you know.
So do you write a lot of poems then?
Yeah, I've got two books published.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What are they called?
Foam Ride and A Palette of Words.
Okay.
And they're in all the London libraries, actually.
So how soon after the film, you know, you make the film, you're thinking, this is a clinker. It's not going to go anywhere. It's a B-movie.
It was fun to be on, though, because everybody was so nice.
Yeah.
Everybody was so friendly. The assistants who can often treat people like dirt, you know.
Yeah.
But they were just nice, you know. And Harrison Ford, he's actually phoned me up a few times on the film. And when my wife took the call, she said, if that's Harrison, I'm the queen. And it was him, and he laughed his head off, you know.
Really?
Yeah, because I told him about it, you know.
That so actually, you make it, you're thinking it's going to be nothing. It comes out, it's the biggest film ever.
Ever.
Did that blow your head off?
We didn't know about it, you know. And I was pleased I was in it, obviously, you know. I mean, of all the films I've done, it's by far the most enjoyable film.
In 2023, we get the third season of The Mandalorian, or sort of season 3.5, I guess, if you count what was in Book of Boba Fett. Pedro Pascal talking about the character to Total Film, and he did discuss one potential avenue for Din Djarin that could be taken if they so choose. Pedro says if he is stepping into a leadership position, he's reluctant to do so. I don't think there's anything more interesting than a character being forced into discovering what they're capable of and who they are. That has been really, really fun. Also, from my point of view, there's so many searchable ways to find the tonality of that. I just tried to achieve the subtleties of that kind of character development. So basically, he's not saying he does or that he thinks he should, but he is saying if Mando was put in a leadership position, it's probably a situation he's reasonably tentative to do. And I think you've got to assume that that's referring to the Darksaber. What do you think of that, Mark? Think some logic to that?
Yeah, I think there's totally some logic, because actually, I think, unless it was the way you read the quote, but it seems like the grammar kind of goes all over the place, because it does kind of sometimes seem like he's talking about stuff he has done, and then also then kind of makes it a bit more vague in that, as if like he's kind of gone, oh yeah, we did this,
yeah,
but I shouldn't really say that. Yeah. And so he's kind of trying to backtrack it a little bit. But it kind of sounds like that's probably what's going to happen in Mando season 3, which is fine. It makes good sense, really. Mandalore the Uniter. I don't have an issue with that. I think it would be interesting. And I do see it would create some really good tension and also some, you know, some drama between him and Bo-Katan. Whilst Bo-Katan is there as a supporter and ally when needed, I also think that they've got two very different ideologies, and therefore it'll be interesting to see how those coalesce in this season. And potentially, yes, you know, are we going to find, through no fault of his own, but yeah, there are people gravitating towards Din Djarin to be the rightful heir of Mandalore rather than Bo-Katan. And obviously, you know, Bo-Katan has got the legacy and she's got the lineage and all that, and so you'd think people would flock to her as well. So we could end up with our own little Mandalorian civil war by the end of season 3.
That sounds like a plan. I like the sound of that. I mean, I think with Mando as a character, like you say, he's a loner. You know, they've played on that lone wolf and cub thing plenty of times in the description of the show with him and Grogu.
Yeah. Mm.
And him and Grogu are back together. And I do wonder, just looking at season 3, and we'll probably never know this, rumours floating that there may be a Book of Boba Fett season 2. We saw some stuff from Spanish-speaking stuff, wasn't it, from a convention?
Brazil.
In Brazil, think, that's right. Yeah. You know, whether that was an error or whether it was fan-made and that just didn't translate to us here in the West reading it, or what the story was. We know that Temuera Morrison would love to do a season 2. Of course he would. And he's kind of inferred that he would like to be the Boba Fett that we all remember, not the Boba Fett that we saw in season 1 of Book of Boba Fett, who was a very different man. You can break down the reasons for why Fett was like that, but clearly Temuera would rather play the gunslinger, Clint Eastwood, speak less, more action kind of Fett. They did put in those two episodes of The Mandalorian, sit in the middle of the Book of Boba Fett. Why they didn't do that as a one-off mini special, I don't know. Or even save it for season 3 of The Mandalorian, because to have that end of season 2 moment and then in another show, almost as an aside, go, oh, hey there, Grogu, on the back of that rickshaw, it didn't quite work. All the tension, the emotion that built so brilliantly in season 2 was given away very quickly. But it's done now, so we can't go back and change it. So in season 3, be interesting to see where we pick up, because you kind of feel like you've got to resolve the Darksaber issue on the bridge of the light cruiser. But you've got Cara Dune there. How do they work their way around that? But in relation to Mando being a leader, you look at his character. Yeah, in combat, he'll take point. He's a bit of a tank. You saw that in season 1 on the prison ship when he was taking all the hits because of the Beskar armor. You know, he can lead in combat. He works well in a team, but he doesn't seem like a leader of men. Much in the same way, clearly, Boba Fett was not a leader of men. You know, whatever motivation took Fett to do what he did in Book of Boba Fett, he got it out of his system by the end of that season, hadn't he? This isn't really for me. He figured it all out in his head. He was kind of back to where you felt like he needed to be, and Fett's going to go and do his thing. And you look at Mando, and he doesn't strike me as a leader of men.
Who, Mando?
Mando, yeah. I'm talking a lot about Fett, but there's quite a few comparisons, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, isn't it? And I think that's always been the kind of issue that we kind of now have with Mando and Boba Fett, in that I think a lot of the traits of Mando is kind of the traits we, you know, would idealize to have in Boba Fett. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, what do? You can't end up with two the same characters, unless, of course, Din Djarin, for whatever reason, kills Boba Fett and steals his armor and then becomes a Boba Fett we know and love. That could be a way to go if, you know, if they felt they needed to. Din Djarin leads not because he wants to, but because he kind of has to. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and we saw that obviously at the end of season 2, Din Djarin's got the Darksaber, so by rights he's meant to be the heir of Mandalore. And I think we've already seen kind of hints that Bo-Katan feels like that is her rightful place to be, is on that throne. And I think there was a sneaky shot of that in the celebration sizzle that they put out for people to watch on blurry YouTube. That is going to be the main thrust of this season. I think that conflict is going to be the thing. So I can kind of see how that is going to work. And if we get a season two of Boba Fett, the question is, again, how does that character evolve? And also, again, with Grogu, you know, because it's like now he's back with Mando. What does he do? Does he now kind of start to forget his Jedi powers? Because that's not what we kind of see in the Book of Boba Fett. You know, we see him training with Luke and awakening even more. So Din's got to, I guess, deal with that and potentially some form of dalliances with the dark side, which will be fascinating if, you know, we've already seen that with Grogu and choking Gina Carano and stuff like that. So I think that will be interesting. But that whole kind of bridge scene, I think, almost doesn't get resolved. People just move on. It may get mentioned about in passing, but I don't necessarily think it will be the focus of any episode.
Lucasfilm and Star Wars in general has the advantage that if they really felt like they had to tell that particular moment, and with Cara Dune as a character, if they need to get Cara Dune out of the storyline, very easy to do, you know, a Marvel one-shot or a short story or, put it in The Insider or, you know, they've got loads of avenues they could put these things in if they wanted to do that. Whatever serves the story the best. That's what Lucasfilm would be thinking in that issue. But just back briefly to Mando, to Din Djarin. I think his focus has been Grogu for so long. Now he's been told by the Armorer he's no longer a Mandalorian. He has to atone. I think that gives them a loophole in him having the Darksaber. If he's a Mandalorian with the Darksaber, that's an issue for Bo-Katan to deal with. If he's just a guy with the Darksaber, it feels like the Darksaber has kind of bounced around for a while. Darth Maul wasn't a Mandalorian and he had the Darksaber. I think it's a different level. And it is always, they've sort of said whoever wields the Darksaber rules Mandalore. But I think it's a different level if it's a Mandalorian wielding the Darksaber. Din Djarin doesn't appear to be the guy that wants to do that. But I just wonder at this time period, you know, 5 or 6 years after Jedi, however far we are now by season three, probably a bit further out, where they want to pitch the Mandalorian culture. Because Grogu had a choice. Luke gave Grogu a choice in Book of Boba Fett. You know, stay with me and train to be a Jedi. We're your people, essentially. Mando's gone to all this effort to take the kid back to his people. And he's delivered to his people. But the kid's made an attachment, which Jedi shouldn't really do. We learned that from Anakin. The kid's made an attachment, saying kid is 50, to Din Djarin. And they get reunited. You've got to wonder where that's going to take Grogu as a character. Because the attachment issue has become a thing. And that sent Anakin down a dark path? Is it going to send Grogu down a dark path? What's Mando going to have to do to deal with this situation? Have we got a teenage group scenario coming up as he gets a little bit more savvy and a little bit more, you know, knowledgeable? Is his memory start to come back? Maybe Luke's unlocked things we didn't see and don't know, but it's quite feasible. So I think season three of Mandalorian is going to be really interesting.
Alrighty then, that is all we have time for episode 145. So thank you very much for listening. And if you would like to send a listener's question in, we would love it. So Mark, can you let people know how we can get in touch?
I would love it too. If you want to be part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit FanthaTracks.com or check out the free FanthaTracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Like Mark says, get those questions in. We'll talk about anything and everything, and goodness knows right now in the Star Wars galaxy with light and magic and Andor trailer and everything else that's coming and going and all about, there's plenty to talk about. Comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at FanthaTracks, and be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semper for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Anna O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Remember, tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on Facebook and YouTube. And check out FanthaTracks Radio on Fridays at 7 o'clock UK for new episodes of The Phantom Down Under, Planet Leia, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Track and Cannon Fodder. And this week, you get a brand new episode of Desert Planet Discs, and that's me done for this episode.
Thank you very much, my friend. Very well read. So there you go. Brilliant. Okay, well, in that case, let's head out here. Until next time, as always, remember, check out FanthaTracks.com and may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's Desert Planet Discs.
He signed my helmet.